Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine. Why are you whispering?
I don't know. I'm just feeling kind of low key tonight.
Oh, it's
Figured I'd bring the
unusual.
energy down a little bit.
Yeah, you're known for your high energy.
I mean, I get riled on occasion. Not usually here, but
yeah,
it's usually late, and we're usually talking about something more exasperating than energetic. But
what could that possibly be? Could possibly exasperate you in the late evening after working all day.
Yeah, it's weird how I run out of energy after expending all of it on silliness.
Interesting. Well, speaking of energy.
Go ahead.
I don't have any either. Yeah, I just coasting through life right now on my... Yeah. Two cups of coffee from this morning. I didn't even have an afternoon coffee. So,
oh, do you normally do multi cups?
I do on occasion. Either if I don't have something to do and coffee would be an activity, or if I'm tired and coffee would be
coffee
necessary.
Is an activity.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's something to do. It fills your time. You're like, oh, I can get a coffee, and then you get a coffee.
So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, getting a coffee with a friend is apparently one of life's ultimate goals.
That is very true, and you can just skip work for the entire day to get that coffee, so it must be some coffee.
I would totally do that. That would be awesome.
Would you skip work to go have coffee with me?
Sure.
Okay, I just want to make sure. There's a lot of laughing before you said yes, but yeah.
Well, I mean, are which one of us is Michelle Monaghan in this situation?
Well, I don't know. I asked you, so technically you're Michelle Monaghan, and I'm.
Oh, I don't want to do that.
I'm the dashing Jake Jellyjill, so you're right. You know,
I took the LSAT or whatever she said. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I would do that. I mean, it's almost Friday. We could play hooky on a Friday, and you know, not do stuff.
So, time travel.
Yeah, well, you know.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Alternate reality computer simulation of another reality thing with a brain.
This movie, Source Code, 2011, by Duncan Jones, which I totally forgot, is about some guys sat down and said, like, well, what would it really be like if we could do something related to time loops or travel or paradoxes and stuff? Like, how would it really go? Like, let's get real about the science. And there's a little bit of hand-wavy nonsense about light bulbs burning out and 8-minute loops and stuff. I don't, you know, I guess light bulbs are extraordinarily precise with the amount of time it takes for them to burn out or something. Oh no, that's the
after image.
It's the RAM in the brain.
Yes. Yeah.
Brain RAM.
Yep.
8 minutes of brain RAM. You know, how would you use some time loop brain RAM to stop a terrorist attack? And you know, alternate realities, parallel realities, you know, forking reality, making a new one. All those fun questions. And then also, it looks like the Matrix, because why wouldn't it? Everything's very dark and kind of green.
I thought it was more cyan.
It's a little cyan, yeah. They rotated a little bit more towards blue than the Matrix did, but it still has a very shot-on-film, color-casted look to it.
Did that bother you?
It was a little weird. I mean, you know, if it wasn't for the color cast and the very dramatic music on your way into it, you're just like, oh, this is some nice scenic footage of Chicago, and you got some ducks here and some rivers and stuff. It's nice.
I thought it was funny in that opening credit sequence, because you hear no sound effects until the first thing you hear is that like goose taking off in the water, and it's just like
it's very loud.
It's like that's the first thing you hear in this movie is a goose. It was an interesting choice.
It's because they really want you to use that as your loop point or whatever. Oh wow, I was wrong. There is some. Oh, no, this is all digital. Wow, this is Red One, Phantom HD, and the Panaflex XL2. Wait, that might be film. I don't know. I don't know anything about Panavisions.
I saw Fujifilm with a credit, in there, and I was a little confused about that one. So
So the Panavision was a film, but I don't. I don't see anything about Fuji. Their printed stock was Fuji. Oh, they shot Kodak and then printed Fuji. That's a pro filmmaker move right there. I don't know what that does, but
I think it saves you money is what it does.
Oh, sure. Okay. Well, I thought it was a look. You know, no. you got color, you got looks and things.
No, yeah, I don't think that was what it was. I'm assuming it was entirely money related, because this movie is primarily shot in Montreal. And all of the VFX studios for it are Montreal based studios. One of them is defunct now, the lead one, Modus. You know, you got your usual suspects, Rodeo, Mr. X and stuff.
Isn't Rodeo Australian?
No. Rodeo VFX, in Montreal, but they're all Montreal. So the important part here is, they were doing this on the cheap. So this film, had a budget of $31.9 million.
Wow.
And they raked in $147.3 million. And according to Duncan Jones, the film has not turned a profit. So he's the victim of Hollywood accounting.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's really the marketing that gets you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good job, Mark Gordon. I don't know if you could tell, but Mark Gordon was involved in the production of this film because he puts
his name
everywhere. He's a producer guy. Mark Gordon Company, etc. You also saw like other stuff, like when you saw the Von Dom logo, and it's just like, that looks like the Lancome logo, but whatever. it's like, yay, a movie.
Is that probably also why they took the faceplates off all the Nokia candy bar phones, so you couldn't tell what they were, and they didn't have to license them?
I guess. It is interesting to think that this movie was in the sort of liminal space of 2011, where you could still have like dumb phones, for lack of a better term, because Michelle Monaghan's phone doesn't have any internet on it. She says if the phone has the internet.
Well, she jokes. She says, mm-hmm. No, it's connected by a very long string, so it does. She's just messing with him because he should know better. But yeah, you know, the other somebody else has one of them little slide out guys with the keyboard underneath it. It looks like a toy. And somebody's Michelle Monaghan, is she the one with the BlackBerry, or is a bad guy the one with the BlackBerry?
There were several BlackBerries. I think the teacher who Jake Gyllenhaal is in has a busted BlackBerry in his thing. So anyway, this is when all of these were viable products. Also, the website that he uses to search was Bing.
And right.
Again, money must have changed hands, because there is no other reason to do that. But
you tell me you don't have Bing as the homepage on your slide out QWERTY keyboard phone from Singular?
No. And that wasn't akin, was it? I don't think so.
It couldn't
be akin. But it's just one of those situations where it's in a very peculiar part of, you know, our past, where it was between, you know, the iPhones and Android phones that we know, and the other stuff of our, I guess, college and high school years, where they just seemingly blend between the two in a weird way that makes it feel like this movie is a little older than it is. Because 2011's not that far in the past. This movie is only 10 years old. March 11th, 2011. So it's not,
wow,
it's not the oldest film. Happy birthday film. It's not the oldest film to depict these devices or anything. It's not the newest film to depict. Anyway, it's weird that you're watching a movie that's 10 years old and it's still not using primarily touchscreen devices that are like iPhones that we primarily consider phones to be nowadays. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's not really the point of the movie. It's just that there are several moments in the movie that rely on looking at phones, so it's worth discussing. The film I thought was pretty interesting in terms of like the script and what all that. Ben Ripley, I was like, is this like based on something? And apparently it isn't. So you know, kudos to him, kudos the candy bar to him. Ben Ripley did a good job. It has a
is he known for things?
Well, nothing amazing. His first credit is for Species 3.
Oh my.
His second credit is for Species The Awakening. And then The Watch before the, after that, and then Source Code. So that's basically the hierarchy. And then apparently Boy Choir, which I don't know what that is, and then a Flatliners reboot.
Yeah.
So, yikes. But, you know, he got the opportunity to do something original, and he did, in my opinion, an excellent job. He basically has a sort of Philip K. Dick-like story here. Of someone playing with reality, of a surreal situation that someone is subjected to, where what is and isn't the truth changes throughout the film. And it's also like RoboCop in a weird way when you're watching it and you're just like, yeah, he's dead. And he's in this thing and it's a simulation and they don't want to tell him he's dead. And then you see the dead body in the box and you're just like, yeah, that's how the RoboCop works. He's just a RoboCop in a box.
Did you enjoy seeing his, partial torso wrapped in saran wrap or whatever?
No, it was like a weird, like plastic shield and it had condensation on it. So it looked weird. It looked like somebody should be taking care of him more than that. Also shaving him, I guess. He had the weird thing where like some facial hair whiskers were longer than others, so it was very scraggly looking in there. And somebody should just like check out on him more often, I guess. But yeah,
they're using him for his brain juices, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things about this movie that I find unusual is that I agree that it's a pretty interesting and competent script. And idea, and it's all put together pretty competently and well, and I don't know, I guess it's interesting, but it feels like it doesn't like really stick the landing or something. Like it doesn't quite make the impact that is memorable, or like this isn't a movie that's gonna end up on a list of stuff I like at any point. But I don't know why, because it's all pretty good stuff. I mean, I like Gyllenhaal. I like Monahan. You know, competently done time stuff is, well, whatever. It's as good as it's going to be. But yeah, I don't know what it is about this movie. It's just kind of like, well, yeah, there you go. That was 93 minutes of, you know, stuff. And now we can get back to whatever we were doing with our lives.
Hmm.
Do you feel differently about it? Do you feel like this is a movie that's going to stick with you?
Oh, well, this is my first time seeing it today, so
yeah,
my ability to anticipate how often I'm going to revisit this is meh. But I think that it seems like something I would remember. I certainly enjoyed watching it at the time. I don't know if it's as interesting to rewatch once you've gone through the twists the first pass through, but I thought it was a very novel thing, which is hard to do in time travel. Well, not time travel, but hard to do in time loop movies. As we've discussed before, they basically all kind of wind up feeling like Groundhog Day, where it's like, yeah, so you got your guy going back in time and reliving the same experience over and over again, and only they remember it, and they're in this cycle. This movie, I feel like, elaborates on that in an interesting way to give it something that makes it set apart from Groundhog Day. Whereas, you know, Palm Springs sets apart from Groundhog Day because it's goofy and is a comedy, like a dark comedy, and can explore other parts of the human psyche because of when they chose to visit our characters who are in this loop together. So that can be something different from Groundhog Day because they're just exploring sort of a different part of the same thing. Whereas with Source Code, you have an entirely different mechanic underlying this. It just has a loop, but how the loop works is totally different. It is artificial and it has an ethical component to it that is different from the other the other avenues. And there is a part of the story that takes place contemporaneously. So he is not just purely in the loop the entire film. He is able to like go back to this, you know, real time, quote unquote, and talk to people there to sort of piece together things, get information, and to share information, and then return to the loop. So it makes it a different sort of experience because, like, you know, in Edge of Tomorrow, they don't like step outside the loop and talk to some other person. They're in the loop the entire time. So
yeah, they've got to waste their time explaining every single time what the setup is, and that becomes kind of part of the difficulty is regaining, you know, making progress. You have to make all the progress you made yesterday and then some, whereas this movie is slightly different. And I guess I kind of misremembered. I thought at some point he tried to bring Michelle Monaghan into the fold and sort of explain to her what's going on and use her as an ally. And, you know, there are a few moments where, like, he says some things to that effect, but she's just sort of like, why are you being weird? I don't understand what's going on here. Like, he doesn't try to fully explain, like, I'm a soldier in a box somewhere and I need help stopping a bomb or whatever.
Yeah, well, and I think that's his movie's credit. The window of time that they loop through is so short that it doesn't provide the opportunity to really drastically change or alter the trajectory of anything. In terms of the character relationships, like, he can't get to know one particular character or something like that as he loops through over and over again. Unlike Palm Springs, where they could, like, familiarize themselves with any town's person that they wanted to through the experience of looping through the entire day. Whereas here you just have 8 minutes, so it makes it a much shorter window in order to familiarize yourself and to also talk to anybody. And so,
plus he's got the ticking clock on the outside world. There's another attack imminent, apparently, that he's got to provide information for.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing that they try to convey through this process, is that the loop, the reason why he's going through these loops is not to change the past, because he's not looping through the past. He's looping through an alternate reality that is accessible to him because his brain is able to be in tune with the memories of this other person's brain. I don't know what they did with that body, if it's in a separate box in a different room, but they...
Oh, yeah, what happened to Sean's body?
Yeah, I don't know. But they're able to use that buffer of 8 minutes from Sean to allow him to tap into this other area and then be able to fully explore it, not just Sean's memories, but be able to explore it as if it were a real place. Whereas, you know, if you were just relying on Sean's memories, that'd be a real short movie because he wouldn't have remembered enough to reconstruct anything. But the film lets him explore every possibility because he's not tethered to just what Sean remembers.
Yeah, which I think is a fairly hand-wavy section of the whole time loop thing. Not entirely clear how that works.
Yeah, it's like, oh yeah, this is because we have 8 minutes of this guy's memories, but it's also just being used to set up another reality. Not that you're not using that 8 minutes of his memory to do anything. So, like, if Sean had been asleep for 8 minutes, would you have enough information there to make another reality? Would you be in Sean's dreams? Would it be a reality of Sean's dreams? Like, what is... Anyway.
I feel like it would be like a 3D camera projection where, like, you would turn around where the camera is and there would just be nothing over there because he didn't look that way in real life.
Yeah. So, the movie, Jeffrey Wright, familiar to most people probably for Westworld, he has the sort of unfortunate task of being the scientist guy behind all this, who says that it's really complicated and that it's quantum mechanics and parabolic whatever, and that they're able to use the 8 minutes of this other person's brain and the similarity of that person's brain to Jake Gyllenhaal's character's name, character, whatever, to be able to have him go to a reality that is like that.
But it also seems that they've selected Jake Gyllenhaal because he has an extraordinary gift for memory.
seemingly so, because he remembers a lot of specific details. Have you ever tried to remember a license plate, Dan?
You know, yes, to the point where I will see a license plate of no consequence, and I'll just be like, I'm going to choose to remember this one right now, and I will, like, remember it, and I'll get, like, a stoplight and a half down the road, and then I'll forget that that car even existed.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, I imagine that part of it is because he's so dedicated to this thing he's doing, but he does nail it in terms of, like, the guy's name and the license plate of the vehicle and stuff when he has to.
I mean, I can do Derek Frost, and he's a weird dude in a white van. I just can't do the California plate 5GY something something.
I think it was 5C.
Well, you know, there was a G in there somewhere.
I thought you said Charlie. But yeah, anyway, it doesn't matter. The movie starts us off inside of one of these loops where Jake Gyllenhaal wakes up. He's completely disoriented. He knows nothing about where he is or the fact that he's in this program. It is not entirely clear how much of the program he really knows about and how much of it is just sort of like programmed in or subliminally he's made aware of, because yeah, he seems to not really have any recollection of it. He remembers being in Afghanistan and the helicopter was shot down, and then he's on a train and he's very confused. Stuff happens that he's going to keep remembering over and over and keeps happening. He eventually sees a reflection of himself in the glass of the train window and then goes to the bathroom to get a closer look, and it's this other guy. It's very Quantum Leap. And speaking of Quantum Leap, his dad is the voice of his dad is Scott Bakula, who we don't see on screen, but it is just the voice of the dad, which I thought was a nice touch just for the Quantum Leap fans. But
oh yes, all of the contemporary Quantum Leap fans.
It was a decent show, sort of.
Did you watch Quantum Leap?
I did when I was a kid. I haven't watched. I don't know if I remember anything enough about it. I thought Dean Stockwell's character being a hologram and he had like Ziggy. That was cool.
Isn't the premise that he's jumping around in time and like he can't leave that period of time until he like helps somebody, and then when he helps them, he just like moves to another period of time and he has no control over it?
Yeah, he's unstuck in time, and he just needs to help people until he can get back to his own time, maybe, sort of. They're not really entirely sure. And every time he sort of inhabits the body of some person in the past. That's basically the premise of that show. So here's Jake Gyllenhaal inhabiting the body of someone, Sean. And
he's quantum leaping 8 minutes at a time.
Yeah, we don't see, it's more of a quantum step, really. Quantum box step. He's
one small step for culture.
One giant leap for
quantum kind.
Sure. But he's just in Sean for this thing. And so he gets to sort of role play as Sean at several points, and sort of piece together all of the things from the various loops. We're not clear from the film how many loops have taken place. It's supposed to be the same day as this train ride has happened.
I think he's been in the box for the 2 months since he quote unquote died.
I think it was two.
And maybe,
I thought it was 2 weeks.
No, they said he's been there for 2 months. I think they've just sort of maybe like connected the TCP/IP settings and made sure that like the communication lines work. But I don't think they've tried to put him anywhere until this. And that's why he's so super disoriented. And they're just sort of like, yeah, let's just play it off. Like, you're not half a torso in a box.
Yeah. And it was, I hate to say it, kind of obvious that he was dead. The circumstances of his death were unclear, and the how dead he was, like in terms of is there a body or is he like a computer program? Like, that was unclear until later. But it seemed pretty obvious that he was not in a real place that existed. Although, interestingly, the inside of the capsule looked sort of like 7 Days. Have you ever seen that show on UPN? That was a time travel show.
No, what is that?
Yeah, it was. It is not as good as Quantum Leap. But I thought
it just looked kind of. It was supposed to be like a representation of the weird little box they got his torso in.
Yeah, except it had all those like triangles and various shapes. So it's more of like a buckyball that he's inside of, or like a contact. But he's. Mm-hmm. He's inside this thing, and at several points, the condition of it deteriorates and is in various forms of disarray. Like when hydraulic fluid was leaking everywhere inside, and Vera Farmiga's Goodwin has to say, like, "Oh, don't worry about that." It's just like, yeah, he's not really gonna have to worry about that at all. But mm-hmm.
when you saw hydraulic fluid in your compartment, that's when you were peeing.
That's all that moisture on that plastic barrier that he has. But he
what is condensation on your torso bag if not pee?
I can't argue with that, really. But he he loops through many times, and he has a affection for Michelle Monaghan's character. And why wouldn't you? Michelle Monaghan, always a delight.
Yeah. And he even jokes. He's like, "Aha! This is a training simulation from the military, and they put the attractive person across from me to distract me so that I wouldn't accomplish my goals. But you're not gonna fool me now."
Yeah, and she doesn't really take too kindly to that, but it doesn't matter because she dies in that reality. They die several times. There are several train explosions. He finds that there is a bomb inside the bathroom. Doesn't know how it got there. It was planted sometime.
I like that he at least finds the bomb very quickly.
Well, to his credit, he's able to piece together from the explosion that it was occurring behind him. And mm-hmm. so he checks just the first thing that was behind him, which was the bathroom. And fortunately, he looked in the like air conditioning panel. Because the first couple times where he's like sticking his hand way down in that trash receptacle thing and that's built into the wall, it's like, I just wince just thinking about how dirty that is.
Well, it's a simulation, so it doesn't matter.
I know. But in some reality, that thing's disgusting. And he opens up the thing, he finds the bomb, but he can't really do anything about it. And he can't talk to Goodwin through the thing. He can only talk to her when he's out of the simulation loop. So he is sort of a victim of this, and she tries to have him information like, oh, there's a pistol in the conductor's compartment, and that just causes more problems. He gets really mm-hmm. frustrated at some point, and
it's tased in the neck.
Yeah, and eventually Goodwin and Rutledge tell him the hard truth that he's dead, and that he's got to do this because he's, you know, a U.S. Army guy, and he has to help all these people because there's a dirty bomb that's going to go off that's actually going to cause a real problem in the actual timeline that they're in. So he needs to take care of it and make sure that that doesn't happen. But he is sort of, I don't know. He's going through a bit of an existential crisis. He doesn't want to like live anymore, and he gets Rutledge to promise that he'll turn the whole thing off afterwards.
You would think that they would have had some sort of plan in place to figure out how to calm a incredibly disoriented, dead-ish soldier, so that they could then focus. Like you gotta make that part of your playbook to like inform them to a certain degree, so that they can, you know, go on ahead with what they need to do. You can't just assume that they'll just blindly follow orders without asking questions when they've been that disoriented.
Yeah, especially at the certain point that they're in. Although, you know, it doesn't seem like they've done this before, that they don't have like a manual about what to do. And they seem to be under the impression that the less information they give him, the more helpful he'll be. But it isn't necessarily the case. He does eventually figure out, after several attempts at identifying an incorrect person, he does eventually figure out that it's the one guy who got off the train and left his wallet. early on. I incorrectly thought it was the bike guy. It was like, oh, he rides on the bike to get far enough away to, like, you know, check out what the situation is. And then when he was, like, harassing the guy who was next to the bike guy, I was like, oh, maybe it's not him. Because then the bike guy would have acted more suspicious. But, you know, so it did actually surprise me in who it turned out to be, mm-hmm. which I think is good. It wasn't like I was yelling at the movie screen the entire time, like, oh, it's that one guy. Because they did a good job obfuscating that. I don't know if that's a result of clever editing or very intentional direction or scripting, but it was a good choice to obscure that, but make it somebody who was on the train the entire time.
And then by the time you do realize it is Derek, you're mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, this guy's totally the worst.
Yeah, and Derek has his rented van with glow-in-the-dark stars on the ceiling and a U.S. flag chest thing full of, I guess, uranium or plutonium. They don't specify. They have radioactive materials and a bunch of explosive material around it. And he shoots and kills Jake Gyllenhaal and Michelle Monaghan and says this evil plan in that reality. But joke's on him because... He and Jake Gyllenhaal is able to convey all this information to Goodwin, and they're able to apprehend the Derek Frost in the reality that they're in to stop that bomb from going off and killing everybody in Chicago. So,
to his credit, he doesn't just immediately shoot him and be like, "Aha, I stopped you." He continues to sort of prod him for information and. Even when he's bleeding out on the ground, asking why, trying to get down to the motive, not just in, it's partially because it's a cinematic death moment, but you know, I feel like he's doing his job of trying to figure out as much as he can to relay back to the command folks when he gets back there.
Yeah. I think some people might be like, oh, he should have just shot him right when he saw him. But it's like, no, you need to see what the van is and you need to see what's in the van. And what's in the box? In order to ascertain whether or not this threat is even real, because they don't know for sure. They just know a bomb went off on that train, and they know there's a threat on Chicago. It's a little unclear to me why he would issue a threat about blowing up downtown Chicago and then just slowly drive there in a van. But I don't know.
Well, you gotta take credit for your stuff.
I guess.
He was very proud of his bomb. He said not a lot of people can make that, remember?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he knows that a better world is going to rise up from the rubble, but first you need the rubble.
You think he wants credit for the new better world?
I mean, I'm sure of it.
He wants to be emperor of the post-apocalypse.
Yeah, he wants to be the emperor of Frostopia. He's going to...
Frostopia, that was those colorful drinks in the 90s, right?
Well, that's also, I was wondering if that was also another intentional thing of like the road not taken, a famous Frost poem that you may be familiar with. I wonder if that was a reason why they called him Frost.
I'm gonna say no.
Okay, probably not as much of a slam dunk as the Quantum Leap thing, but so using all this information, they can keep the guy from blowing up stuff. They're all having a party. Jake Gyllenhaal selling a box. He gets Goodwin to agree to let him travel back for one more 8-minute loop so that he can defuse the bomb and prevent that from happening in that reality, even though it won't affect anything about the reality that they're currently in. And yeah. That
he can go be Superman now because he knows the exact sequence of events. He's going to turn off the bomb. He's going to defeat Derek. He's going to call his dad. He's going to make that coffee date that he was, you know, kept postponing in order to save the world and stuff. And he's just going to enjoy it. He's just going to enjoy his last 8 minutes. He's going to bring some joy to those people on that train. He's going to pay off the comedian guy who's down on his luck because he got hit with 2 DUIs or something to entertain the crowd so everyone can be happy right before they die or whatever.
Yeah. And he wants Goodwin to turn off his life support basically at the end of the 8-minute loop. She's reluctant to do that at first, but she's an Air Force officer, it seems. And so she feels a certain sense of responsibility about this that Rutledge does not have. Rutledge is your unethical scientist guy.
There's a pretty good line there about, you know, ask any soldier, they'd say one death is enough to pay for the service or whatever. And maybe, I don't know, the ethical component of the story is very important, but maybe the, like, you know, sad, mostly dead guy in a box, just let me die or whatever kind of stuff is sort of the weird feeling over top of this movie that kind of overrides it. It's a little, I don't know, it's a little going out in a blaze of glory kind of thing, but at the same time, it's important to mention the whole, like, being forced into never dying is kind of messed up, and you should be allowed to die if you want, I guess. I mean, the only thing worse than living forever is living forever, like, against your will. Although I guess most stories, people live forever against their will, you know, vampires and the such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and everybody in those stories is happy.
No, of course not.
I think it's important. An important part of this is the ethical component of he is at the disposal of whatever the U.S. government wants of him. He has no recourse. He has no other alternatives. He has no way to naturally die. So he's just stuck for forever, looping through multiple deaths anytime they want to use him to stop something bad from happening. And he does stop something bad from happening. He doesn't regret that in the film. And seemingly his email that he sends to the alternate Goodwin in the other reality indicates that he doesn't regret it, but that there needs to be some sort of agreement in place about, like, what are the responsibilities to this person that you're putting through this. And he was able to convince this good one in this reality. I don't know what's going to happen in the other realities, but he's dead at the end of this. And mm-hmm. his mind, though, is seemingly in another plane of existence. Unless this film is like, this is the afterlife, and now it's just all spiritual, which would be a weird pivot. I think the movie really wants you to know that he's gone to the other reality.
Right. I think this is inside that, like, Sean. Yeah, exactly. It's like if you jacked into the Matrix, but you were inside somebody else, and then they unplugged you and your body died, and then your brain just stayed in that person, and you got to live in the Matrix forever. You know, the Goodwin thing is interesting because she obviously plays the sort of balance and the ethical component, but at the same time, she's also kind of a bad soldier because, you know, she, like, lets him back in without approval. She's the one who's going to kill him and ruin the whole experiment. But, you know, it's because she's good or whatever, or I guess that she's siding with the soldier over top of the science nerd who's just abusing the soldiers because he's got a sweet government contract.
Yeah, I mean, he's talking about how he's going to have 8 source code projects up by the end of the year with enough funding. So that's 8 more dead soldiers to keep forever. 7 more dead soldiers to keep forever in addition to the one he already has. And he's just going to mind wipe the existing soldier. And I think that might be what really sold Goodwin on it, is that she didn't want to participate in a program where this guy's mind would be wiped and he would just be subjected to this over and over and over again.
Yeah, but she also knows that he's a bad science dude in the alternate reality there, where she gets an email where it's like, whoa, we did a time loop, and she doesn't tell him right away. Like, I would be real excited to be like, hey, we forked reality and it worked, and that thing that you just saw was us, which is pretty nifty.
Yeah, but I think it's wise of her to keep that close to her vest, you know, close to herself, because... Could you imagine what he would be thinking if he knew that he could affect the outcomes of other realities or travel to them?
Well, I feel like that information needs to be relayed at some point so you understand the consequences of what you're doing, or they'll figure it out some other way.
Yeah, well, but, he'll figure it out later.
It would be useful to know that you can ostensibly fork reality at any given time.
Yeah, the real bummer is Sean of that reality that Jake Gyllenhaal goes into at the end. Because that Sean would have died on the train had Jake Gyllenhaal not defused the bomb and all that. But at the same time, now Jake Gyllenhaal lives forever inside of Sean's body.
He doesn't know any of his PIN numbers. He doesn't know where he lives. He doesn't know any of his passwords.
Yeah, and Sean doesn't live here anymore. Sean's
going to have to find a new career because he's not going to be a qualified teacher anymore.
No, Sean's going to have some problems, I'm going to imagine, integrating into life. But so, and something else also, this movie ends on a cheery note of them getting coffee and going to Millennial Park and hanging out at the Bean, there at the end. But the movie ends on that note. But he doesn't know about Millennial Park or like Chicago. So I feel like that's going to be a road bump that's going to be pretty quick for him and Christina. Is like, so you don't know anything about us or where we are. So it was great having coffee with you, but you
think at some point he's going to have to explain the whole situation to her?
Yeah. And I have to imagine that it's going to be hard to explain. Yes, I traveled to an alternate reality and took over the body of somebody you know, and they would have died, but now they're not dead, but I am in their body and they maybe are nowhere in existence. So I'm sorry about that, but also I have all of his stuff and I love you.
I mean, maybe he's just good enough at recon that he can sort of like fake it till he makes it, until he can learn how to be Sean.
Yeah, that's going to be psychologically really helpful for him. But you know, that's for the sequel to this.
It's a whole new him, yeah. He said. So he can just be like, you know what? I'm turning over a new leaf. I'm gonna be new Sean. Also, call me Coulter. Which, okay.
Well, you know, the writer should have named the character after himself so that he'd be the talented Mr. Ripley.
No.
He'd be taking over the life of somebody else. So anyway,
Have you seen that movie? You've
no,
seen that movie.
I haven't seen the movie.
Oh god.
Yeah.
You should go see that one. It's it'll make you feel bad about your decisions in life.
Yeah, you said that before when I suggested we do it for the podcast. So then I was like, well, okay,
it's just
I guess
a
we won't.
Downer.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I thought this movie was pretty good. It ends on a positive note because I think they wanted to end on a positive note, but I think the reality is they probably should have ended with the simulation ending when everything
the
freezes.
The freeze frame?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
But then they wouldn't have... Would the email thing still have been useful?
Well, I mean, it could have been. Because he sent that before the freeze frame happened. We could have just cut directly to that. I think the weird part is giving him a happy ending where he's inhabiting another person's body for the rest of his life, or the rest of Sean's life for that matter, and that he's going to have to deceive this person, but it's played as like, what a romantic day at the park.
Well, you know, they don't know each other that well, as she says, you know, what do we assume? They're colleagues, friends, or something?
It seems that they commute on the same...
they met on the train, is that right?
My assumption from the movie is that they met on the train and they commute together. And that's why they don't know much about them, but they had an attraction to talking to one another about things, which is why he knows some things about her and she knows some things about him. I should say Sean knows.
I've been on one of those trains. I never felt the need to speak to anyone.
Oh God, no. I would, if somebody... You know the Walter Reed lady up there where she's like, don't talk to me. She's like looking away. Like, that's me. That's what I would do.
If you walk all the way up to those incredibly like narrow, short seats on the second floor there and you like loom over me staring at me, I'm going to push you over the railing because you're probably going to assault me.
Also, is it just me or does that seem very unsafe? Like, is that really what those trains are configured like?
Yeah.
Oh man.
there's the second story up there with like I don't think there's that much headroom up there where you just gotta kinda shimmy down the side.
No, I've been on the Amtrak the surf liner that goes from San Diego to Los Angeles, and that one is a double decker, but it doesn't have a hole in the middle. It doesn't try to have like an atrium in your train. It has just a complete second floor and a complete first floor.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Yeah.
You know, these weird Chicago trains are the ones that take you from the suburbs to the city. That's exactly what they are.
Weird. Well, they, it's a very interesting movie, and I feel like maybe the ending could only be improved by making it sort of a less cheerful I've taken over somebody else's body. Kind
but
of
most
scenario.
Of the movie is pretty sad anyway. You got Gyllenhaal dealing with the fact that he's dead, and you know, he left a bad relationship with his estranged father, and he wants to try and mend that, and his buddies in Afghanistan are also probably dead, and he's going to die again, and he's in a box, and just, please let me die, I'm a monster, and he communicates with bleep bloops and binary, like, you know, they even show the binary on the screen, which is a little silly, and the red blinking light, that is probably some other form of communication for him. There's a lot of bummer stuff in here that you gotta balance with the look at me saving people, even though it's a fake time loop, but oh no, it also turns out it's an alternate reality fork in the time space continuum.
Yeah, it just, that doesn't bother me very much. Cause I'm fine with a sad movie. I think trying to affix a happy ending to this with these characters that barely know each other and taking over someone else's body is just strange.
I think it's about as forced as saying Jeffrey Wright is this sort of like, screw humanity, I'm doing it all for the Nobel Peace Prize / government funding kind of thing.
What?
Jeffrey Wright, he's just like, I don't care about abusing the dead guy in the box. I'm just going to do whatever I want as long as I can get money and things.
I mean, I believe that most of all.
I don't know. I mean, I guess if but, you know, generally sciencey people usually are more curious about what they're doing than they are about how is this going to enrich us.
Well, someone hasn't
in
watched
movies, not in reality.
Someone is unfamiliar with Silicon Valley at all, or you know. Elon Musk, or I don't know, anything has
well,
to do with
Elon
technology
Musk's
and money.
Not actually programming the time loop box.
Could if Elon Musk had a time loop box, like Brain X or whatever, if he had the ability to send someone who had died in one of his autopilot crashes back in time to figure out why the autopilot doesn't work or something, then he would totally do it.
Install the source code right into the car, so you could just loop right back where you were.
Yeah, he would absolutely do that without any qualms. He'd just be like, oh, this is the best thing in the world because then we'll be able to improve our product. And then he would just keep that person there forever because then he wouldn't have to tell anybody about it.
Yeah, if you die in a Tesla, the end user license agreement basically says you'll be stuck in a time loop for all eternity beta testing our vehicle until we can solve that particular problem.
Yeah, so I think the ethics of people are bad in general.
I guess the nerdy fellow that was running the computer, he seemed a little bit more normal.
Yeah, but he's following orders, man. He's just following orders, which, you know, is the same thing as participating in that kind of thing. But good one. I like good one. I also like the Vera Farmiga, so it's good. It's good to have her in here.
Yeah, she's good at making very subtle expressions that communicate sadness and understanding.
I also liked that was a role that went to a woman who was not a love interest, because it's nice to be able to have a more rounded out cast of characters in this, where the only woman in here isn't Michelle Monaghan as the romantic interest, which would have been a disappointment. Which was nice to have it sort of balanced out with somebody else who had a role to play in this that was more substantial and meaningful to what was happening in the plot.
Yeah, she had a good role. Michelle Monaghan is probably. Probably wanted to shoot herself by the end of this because she didn't really get to do anything other than act confused and naive for the entire length of the movie and really no growth or goals or anything in particular. She just kind of has a speech she does a few times and then is kind of pleasantly surprised that her train buddy is turning a new leaf and like, let's go look at the shiny guy.
I always feel bad for Michelle Monaghan. I feel like she should have more opportunities than she's been granted. She's in a lot of stuff, but like only for like little bits of things. Her big roles that I really think about are like, you know, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and Mission Impossible 3, and then her very brief appearance in Ghost Protocol. But like, she should be more stuff, I think.
Her the first thing listed on her IMDb in the known for section is Pixels.
Oh dear.
So I assume she has a starring ish role in that, but I don't want to watch it to find out. I've seen a few minutes of it, and it made me hate the concept of movies.
Yeah, I can't say I want to watch that, but you know, just good for her for collecting a paycheck, I guess.
She's good.
And Jeffrey Wright's good in this. I like him. He's a bad person.
I'm not sure why they had to give the cartoonish the nerd with the crutch thing that they were doing there.
It was a weird affectation to have him doing the little comb over thing at the end into the mirror.
He's a weird evil nerd, but also vain somehow. He's like Guy Pearce's character from Iron Man 3 before he turns into an extremist thing.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, good movie.
Source Code. The name. I don't like the name. I don't like that they called the program Source Code, but that's fine.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not good. I would have come up with a different name for it. I like how they kept saying it, like, "Oh, we need to send him to the Source Code." And it's like
words mean something, and that.
No. It's like they should have just called it something else. Just said time loop. Time loop movie. Send him to time loop.
Loop box.
Yeah. Or loop back. Did you ever watch The Time Tunnel?
I don't know what that is. It was a show.
An old Irwin Allen, the guy who did Lost in Space in the 60s. He had a show called Time Tunnel, where it was a government experiment where they had
this
weird time tunnel thing, which was mostly a matte painting thing. And
oh my God, somebody's floating through a kaleidoscope.
Yeah, they would send, they had these two guys that got sent back, and it was sort of like, this was the precursor to Quantum Leap, where they're sent back to a different spot in time, and they would try to retrieve them, and then it would go awry, and they'd go to a different spot in time. It never quite worked out. They weren't inhabiting anybody's bodies, they were just traveling through the time stream to different places. But it was an interesting idea. But, you know, I also like that this movie isn't trying to say that he can affect the past, that he can only affect alternate realities. I think that's a safer route to go with this stuff. Yeah.
They say several times the time only going forwards out here in the control room. Mm-hmm. And same thing with him, basically. He's only going forward. They can just reset him. Did you ever watch Timeline?
No. What's that? Was that the Michael Crichton one? No.
Yeah, I never watched the movie. I read the book and actually really liked the book. And then they're like, it's a movie starring Paul Walker. And I'm like, no, thank you.
I just saw the trailer for that movie. And I was like, ugh, that looks bad.
I found the book to be pretty interesting. It's probably over here on my shelf somewhere still. Mm-hmm. But I read it a long time ago. No. Oof. Time travel.
Time travel is messy business. The other week I watched Cause and Effect after we recorded, and which was that Star Trek Next Generation episode I was telling you about, they are reliving this loop, and they just sort of have this sense of deja vu every time they go through the loop, of sort of like half of a memory of doing stuff that they've done before, not quite the complete memory, and it's for everybody on the entire ship. As they go forwards each time through the loop, more people remember more of it, but they forget every single time it resets, and then they have to remember that they remember each time, and they were able to finally come up with a way to send a message that could only be a couple characters long into the past in order to affect the outcome to prevent the ship from blowing up. because that's what causes the loop every single time. Huh. The ship explodes.
It's the Omega 13.
Yeah. Well, no. Because they go through the loop, ship explodes, go through the loop, ship explodes, etc. And then they're able to send this message, and they can't figure out what the message is until the very last second, and then they're able to keep the ship from blowing up. And because they do that, they stop the loop from happening. And then they find out the other person who was in the loop with them was Dr. Fraser Crane, and he had been in the loop on his ship since like 80 years before that or whatever. And they don't know how that happened, because every single time he blew up in the loop, it was because they ran into him, into them. But there would have been an 80-year gap. So how they did that, I don't know. But it was just an interesting thing to watch. One of the more interesting time things that Star Trek has done.
Do you prefer movies like this where they try and take the time stuff very seriously? Obviously, you don't want anything that is overtly distracting and sort of like making you question how the mechanics of the time work. But do you feel an extra little bit of vindication when a movie sort of or a TV show is really playing by the rules of time as we know them currently?
No, I care less about what the rules of the time stuff are, what the shenanigans that they're doing are. Just as long as it's consistent internally to the logic of the story.
As long as it's not boring.
Well, that too. Because another one that often comes up, and listeners, please don't suggest that we would talk about this movie because I won't do it, is Primer. Also usually called Primer, but it's supposed to be Primer.
Yeah, comes up all the time. I've never seen it.
Yeah, it's by the dirtbag Shane Carruth, which is why we're not going to do it. And he, it was like his first film, I think, and he's in it and directing it and, you know, many other credits as he is wont to do. But it's basically a box where you crawl inside and then you wake up in the box when the box was made or whatever. So the box is the thing that has to be consistent, so you can never set it up. You can't like go back to the time of the dinosaurs or something, but you can go back to an earlier part where the box existed, and then you wake up in the other part of the box. You still like sort of go to sleep in there or whatever and wake up. So it's this thing, and people like have diagrammed the loops that are inside of it in order to do the time travel, and it's gotten a lot of acclaim for it. It's really shoddily made. It has just like things like terrible audio, like they're standing in front of a fountain and you can't hear any of the audio because it's just all the fountain noise. And the grain is too strong because they didn't have lights, so they just shot film in front of at nighttime, and it's just like, you guys. It was just a hacky thing, but it was like a fun thing to like point at and be like, what a mess. And then unfortunately, when the truth about like Shane Carruth as a person came out, in terms of like how he was treating the women in his life, then it was less fun. So we will not be talking about that movie. Screw Shane Carruth, basically. But that's one that often gets discussed. I don't really care so much about the fact that it had like an airtight loop. The fact that it was just a terrible movie, I think is a higher problem for me in that case. You're right that it needs to have some sort of entertainment value. It doesn't need to be happy entertainment. I don't need to be like, woo, yeah. Every time they're like looping through, oh yeah, you did the loop. Like, I don't need like that level of engagement. I just need like to have my mind engaged in this process. It needs to be good filmmaking, like Source Code is. You know, this is good editing. This is Paul Hirsch, for heaven's sake. It's you know, decent cinematography here. It's everything's, you know, pretty tight and bright, and it works. And so I enjoy stuff like that. Or like when we did Palm Springs, like that is a more leisurely paced thing in comparison, although it is, I think it is basically the same runtime. The stakes are lower, shall we say. But I enjoy something like that too, because it's goofy. Like, it doesn't make any internal sense about a lot of the stuff that's in there, but it's fun to watch and to think about the experience mentally of like what you would do in a sort of a similar situation where you were living something or trapped in something. And I think that kind of mental experiment is fun. Regardless of what the actual quantum mechanical components of it are in reality.
You're like a mental experiment. You like you like thinking through your what ifs and your sciences and your things because you like the Star Treks and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, although Star Trek has had a lot of really bad time travel. Scott Bakula himself was the was a captain in Star Trek. Do you know?
I watched an episode of that.
It was I forgot you were on you're on Random Trek and Scott gave you the one with the weird alien language that's so bad.
Yeah, the people who needed help, but helping them meant that they wouldn't be able to save themselves, so they said that they wouldn't help them.
Yeah, it was so bad.
Or something.
Anyway, they had time travel on that. Enterprise was, I think, most critically derided for the central, I guess, theme or mechanism or whatever through line for the show was a time travel thing of the temporal Cold War, which was various factions in the future sending agents or materials or other things to the past in order to affect what would happen for their faction to try to benefit their faction in the future. It was convoluted and could have been interesting in another setting, but was bad for a television show like that in that time and was very un-Star Trek.
Yeah, I mean, that's Tenet, that's Looper, that's lots of stuff. The whole we don't have time travel now, but in the future they will, and they can use that to enrich themselves by sending knowledge or whatever back in time. There's only so much you can do with that before it just gets annoying.
Well, there was none of it they did before it got annoying. So it was, they can't all be winners. Not all the time travel stuff can be winners.
How come my great, 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 great grandchildren who have time travel can't send me, you know, some stock tips or something so I can get super duper rich and then they can be wealthy generations later as a result? Just seems like logical. Like, why aren't they on that already?
I mean, they probably got something like the Temporal Prime Directive where you can't interfere with the past.
No, they're probably just too distracted with their year 3000 TikToks or whatever, holographic TikToks.
But if your grandkids could do that, then wouldn't everybody's grandkids do that?
Yeah, well, I feel like mine should be a little bit more ambitious than others.
What would lead you to that conclusion?
Just general anxiety and overthinking. Like, you know, you got to do something with your efforts.
What would you say you've done with your efforts?
Well, I don't have the time travel. If I had time travel, I would find all kinds of creative ways to send money back in time to my grandparents.
I know, but that's what I'm saying. Is like, how are you expecting this of them when you yourself are falling short?
Fine, I will get working right now on enriching my great grandparents who are dead.
But they won't be dead if you send them the stuff.
Oh, they'll still be dead, but I just will have inherited all of their money and things.
Okay.
By the time I'm done, I'm going to own half of Ohio.
Well, make sure it's the good half, I guess.
No, there's not a good half.
I don't know. I was listening to an episode of a podcast about the Northeast and Southwest or Southeast and Northwest or whatever. I don't care.
You got the factories in the Northeast and you got the farms in the Southwest.
Sounds fun.
No,
I don't know. You could buy up all the Skyline Chili in Cincinnati. You could be the chili magnate of Ohio.
Yeah, I don't really like Cincinnati that much.
Mm. What's your favorite spot in Ohio?
Because it's good or because it's my favorite?
Well, that's interesting to dissect. What would be the difference between a good spot and your favorite spot?
There are very few places in Ohio that are objectively good, but there are places that are like family things. Like, there's the chicken restaurant that I've been to where like my dad worked when he was like 10, and like five other people in his family also worked there because that's like. It was the big chicken restaurant in town when they were living there, and it's still around, and there's not much else in that town. So I like that place to go get some chicken, Hungarian chicken stuff. So, it's not, like, objectively good.
When I asked you for your favorite spot in Ohio, you picked a chicken restaurant.
I did, yes.
So, like, if you were, like, to, I meant, like, to live or something. I meant, like, a city or a town or something.
No.
But you want to live in a chicken restaurant?
I would live adjacent to the chicken restaurant.
Next to the chicken restaurant, just so everything just smells like chicken all the time.
Oh, yeah, it smells good. No. No to all of that. I don't want to live anywhere there. I mean, I almost bought a house in Canton one time.
But why?
So they wouldn't sell it.
Oh.
They were selling my grandma's house, and I was like, well, why don't I just buy it? We'll just keep it. Like that would have been
that would have been
the end of 2019, which would have been an amazing investment for the past year and a half.
I don't think your grandmother would have approved of that particular course of action.
No. Look, don't move to Ohio. Anybody?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody.
Especially
don't go to Ohio.
Not Dan's time traveling grandkids.
Except that one guy who works at Dropbox who is from New York but finds Ohio amazing for some reason. I talked to this guy a couple months ago. He went to college in Ohio because some friends he knew were there, and he loves Akron, Ohio, and he goes there like every other weekend to hang out with friends. I was like, boy, okay. You live in New York and you like Ohio on purpose.
Well, that's weird. Because isn't Akron just like tire factories?
Used to be tire factories. Now it's like two hospitals and a college.
I love that sitcom.
Exactly.
But speaking of sitcoms, I've always kind of wanted to go to Cleveland because of that episode of 30 Rock where Liz Lemon flees to Cleve, as Jack Donaghy says when she talks about how much she likes being in Cleveland. Just always seemed like an interesting place to visit, but like. Not a place I want to use any vacation days to visit. No. Not a place that I want to fly to visit.
You can give yourself an extended layover there on your way to...
Where?
I don't know, Prince Edward Island or something?
See, I would just want to... It would be one of those situations where, like, if I was, like, driving cross-country, maybe I'll go through it or something. Like,
no,
that kind
of... There's no reason. You would have to go out of your way. There would be no reason to drive through Cleveland.
What if I was driving through cross-country to like, Maine or something? Who knows?
I feel like you would end up going through Columbus and then, like, Pennsylvania.
Well, is Columbus better than Cleveland?
Depends on who you ask.
Well, I'm asking you.
Do you like college towns, or do you like things that look like downtown LA from 10 years ago that are just starting to get restaurants and bars and stuff that are interesting?
I guess the latter.
So there you go, Cleveland. You can stop by the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You can eat at a place with lots of Edison bulbs and metal chairs and high top tables and, you know, try to avoid getting hit by a car.
Okay. Well, yeah.
Sounds Cleveland. Exciting. Cleveland.
Why couldn't this movie have taken place in Cleveland instead of Chicago?
Oh, because they would be like, it's going to blow up in Cleveland. And be like, no one will notice the difference. It's fine. It's a dirty bomb. Cleveland's dirty. It's fine.
I mean, I always kind of thought that when they were talking about Chicago, I was like, eh. So it's like, you know, wake me up when it's New York or LA or something.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they were trying to clean up their act, right? 2011. I don't know what it's like comparatively now, but
talking about places I have no desire to go to. Chicago.
Chicago's not bad. I mean, yeah. You don't literally walk down the street and get stabbed the way everyone describes it.
That wasn't primarily my concern. Everybody from Chicago thinks Chicago's great. And it's like, calm down. Jeez.
They're like, get a load of this. It's a big city. We're like, yeah, there's other ones. We've been there.
Yeah, they're like, it's big. It's like New York, but it's better. And it's like, I don't like New York either. So I don't know. I mean, what are you trying to prove?
Not as big as New York.
Yeah, no. But I don't care about it at all. So.
It's like a darker, colder, windier San Francisco.
Oh, that's what they call it. The darker, colder, windier city. I don't know. I mean, I like San Francisco. I like visiting San Francisco. I don't want to live in San Francisco. Jesus Christ. But
I don't think you're allowed to live in San Francisco. I think that's against the law.
No, I think they have erected financial barriers to that.
Giant buildings with Twitter logos.
Yeah. Imagine building a fence, but it's with debt. And then you can keep everybody out. I don't know. I like driving through it. Speaking of, drive through it quite often on the way back from wine country.
Do you go over the Golden Gate for that, or do you go over the Bay Bridge for that?
Well, unfortunately, several times we've gone over the Golden Gate Bridge because we're like, oh, it'll be so pretty. And then we just say to ourselves, we should have gone over the Bay Bridge because, Jesus Christ, it's taking forever. Because then you go on a, what is it? It's not PCH, is it? Is it the one? Whatever it is? Like, the Golden Gate.
Isn't that the 5?
No. You get to the 5 way later. Actually, I think it's the 101 or something. You get to first. Anyway, you're just driving forever on this stupid, like, I don't know, 5-6-lane road. Past all those, like, old row homes and stuff. And it just, like, takes forever. There's so many stoplights.
Mr. Highway from L.A.
I mean, I wouldn't mind. It's just that it's so full of traffic that it's no fun. Like, if it was traffic lights and it wasn't, like, also full of cars, then that would be a different story. But when it's, like, traffic lights and you're just, like, crawling for miles.
Can't the locals commute through some less scenic route so that they can leave the Golden Gate Bridge to the Instagram folks?
Yeah, I mean, take Muni or whatever. Take your BARTs and what have you.
Mm. TM says technically Golden Gate is both Route 1 and 101.
Ah.
So, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for the real-time follow-up.
I knew it had a 1, but the Golden Gate is so pretty to drive over. Unfortunately, you're stuck in that other part. It's just no fun. But that's reality. It's life.
Bridges.
Mm-hmm.
Of Golden Gate County.
It's not.
All right, well.
I'm not a county.
Let's reset our 8-minute loop and then we'll try this again next week.
And we just convince somebody to push that big red kill the life button.
Please kill me. I'm so tired. So tired.
What if we've just been doing a loop where we've discussed this podcast in many different realities over and over and over again, and we just aren't aware of the loop? Like, what if every version of reality you're actually going through all the time and you're just not aware of it? You're only aware of one of them.
It's real deep, man. Isn't that the multiverse?
Yeah, but what if, like, all of a sudden you were aware of all the other ones and you're like, oh no, I'm insufferable in all of these other realities.
I got too many things to worry about already, to let alone the multiverse.
Yeah. All right. Well, until then, until our problems multiply. So long.
Sounds like a song lyric.